Hi, I'm Aaron Sarofsky.
And I'm Austin Shaw.
This is Between the Keyframes.
This week, we're going to talk about the history of now, and we're going to introduce ourselves to y'all.
What we're doing and why we're doing it. What are we doing here? That's the perfect open for our first episode, if you ask me.
I was thinking about this whole idea of the history of now, and I was thinking about us. I know you just said Sarofsky's 2009, so like, you know, 11, you're into your 11th year, 10th year, you know, 11, 10, 11 years. And we met probably in like 07, 08 or something. And we were kind of like, you know, we've talked, like we were in a very similar-ish places, both kind of working as kind of creative leads in our capacities. And you started Sarofsky, and then I transitioned to becoming a full-time professor, and then it's like 10 plus years later. You know, at that time when we met, like Superfad was on top, like King of the Hill, like one of the top shops. I remember it was like the Xbox commercial came out, that insane one that was like, And then there was the whole Sprint campaign. You remember this, like, you couldn't turn on a TV and not see a Sprint commercial that was done in that crate, that really fun style with lots of green screen.
Isometric.
Just, they created just a really awesome system for branding. I mean, I remember when I first started teaching, that was a case study I would show because I thought it was, you know, super effective. But at that time, the 30-second commercial and broadcasts were still king, right? Like that was the job, you know, outside of like corporate videos, right? What do you think have been like the fundamental shifts from, say, 10 years ago?
I think like our world, like motion design, commercial production, not necessarily so much entertainment, but I think it's driven by like the tides of humanity and what's going on in culture and in the world. I think just over 10 years ago or 10 years ago, like anything like digital was like a miracle. We were through the dot-com boom and like we were doing back in the day at Budweiser commercials at DK that were like all these like high speed phantom camera, but like super high contrast design world with like graphics integrated. Nobody had ever seen anything like that before. It was like, you know, print design and overly stylized or heavily stylized, right? And so that look was like very 90s early noughts, right? Like it was very of a time. And then I think things just got simpler, right? Things just got simpler. Comedy became more of a thing, like dry comedy. So like, instead of even having like logos animated at the end, it would just be up, you know? Like Apple went from like dancing, iPod, beautiful silhouettes to like minimal lifestyle photography with the logo, right? So stylistically, everything had shifted. In my view, to like very, very minimal, dry comedy and to big global, like Pitka style campaigns where it's like, you know, vast landscapes and this and that. And you could shoot overseas really cheap. So people were sending people to shoot that way to get humanity in. They really wanted humanity, all of that diversity, humanity. The whole ethnically ambiguous. And so that became the look. So design kind of heavily design driven things like really became few and far between. You didn't see cars driving down the road with swirling graphics around it anymore. Like the days of that were like over. Honda doing that, all Toyota, like those campaigns didn't exist anymore. So the few that there were, everybody was fighting tooth and nail to get, you know, but there really, it wasn't like in vogue. But also what's interesting during that time was the boom and growth of Facebook and Google. And so they needed a style and a look that could support their quick generation of content needs, from explainer videos to widgets like the
totally
paperclip. Totally. Remember that guy from Microsoft?
Wasn't that guy called like Clippy or something?
But they needed that times a million. And then emojis became a thing and bringing them to life. And how do we elevate? And I think that's the need for developing content in that way is what exploded people like Buck in that like that look. And it just, I mean, it's so sexy and it was new. Like nobody had seen, you know, what essentially people would call clip art, you know, look so fucking fantastic. You know, I remember seeing the first view and I'm like, this is like clip art. What is everybody so excited about? It's like cell animation and clip art, but artfully done and edited beautifully with the right music. And again, artistry, it, you know, and you're not paying talent, like face wise, you're not paying for any of that. Most of it had type. So you weren't even paying the VO artist. So you could really kick that shit out really quickly.
I guess you could think maybe a precursor to the whole design with sound off. Because now we have this whole, there's like best practices, but there were no best practices. Like we had to figure out what was the best practice.
Right.
Well, also I remember when we talked, I think it was when I was working on the second edition of Design for Motion. Early in that draft process, we got on the phone and you kind of filled me in a bit. This is when I was like, I guess I have to pay attention to social and like really kind of research what does it mean and what's happened. And you said something to the effect of, you know, it used to be with social, it was this sort of add-on kind of throwaway on the deliverables list. And now this is probably, we're looking at maybe 2015, 16, we're having this conversation. And it was like, that's not the case anymore. Now it's, they want the high production quality. They want it to feel just as good as they'd want a 30-second spot. So for you, I mean, we're that discovering some of those best practices, is that something that just happened organically? Was it ever explicitly given to you in a brief, in like brief form or?
It was organic. And accidental. I mean, we started doing some of that like cell animation, which we try so desperately not to do as cell animation because of just how long it takes and how laborious it is. And I don't know about anybody else's clients, but our clients have feedback, and feedback is very hard to address in that world. So we didn't have a structure or a pipeline for how to handle that well. So we mostly do it CG and then have it that flat rendered look, which I think most people do that
much
that
easier
way
to
buy now.
Which is crazy to think like, oh yeah, CG is gonna be easier, right? Like it used to be like, ooh, CG, that's gonna cost, right? Right. You know, that's interesting too, because I think in that sort of mid 2000s, I noticed in the educational realm, all of my motion design students and all, but there was a trend. It was that liquid, right? They wanted to learn liquid animation. They wanted, and all of a sudden, like Photoshop, like the timeline in Photoshop became, you know, and for me, I didn't have a traditional animation education, but I'm always curious. I'm like, let me figure this out. And it was actually really great. I had some animation grad students who were really into learning motion design. So I'd get them to do demos for my students. And then I'd be like, okay, cool. I'm learning now too. And then I incorporated that into my intro to motion classes and it just became a part of it. And now like, you know, and I always caveat it with things like, you know, all right, dedicated 2D traditional animation, they're going to be using, you know, Toon Boom and TV Paint and Animate, which used to be Flash. But I'd still teach it like Photoshop because it's like, look, this is really approachable. This is how we get it into After Effects. And this is where we can kind of do some different things with it. But even things like Procreate, I don't know if like artists in your studio are messing on the iPad with like Procreate, but like they got a like an animation assist timeline that is like, and Rough Animator and some of these apps that become really just accessible for that type of animation.
I mean, if I were your student, I would be super into that. That work is really sexy looking. It's kind of somewhere in between traditional animation, like going to almost like film school, like animations, character animation school, like the Pixar school direction and design. because you're learning like these fundamentals in an interesting way.
I've also found was really neat because, you know, I would get a lot of different majors taking an intro to motion class. And whenever I had animation majors, and I'd be like, okay, we're going to do this in Photoshop. And I'd be like, don't worry, you can do it in whatever program you want. The thing that was cool was to see their eyes light up when I would take whatever little simple animation I'd create with an alpha channel into After Effects, and then I'd start duplicating and offsetting and rotating and changing and offsetting in time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they wouldn't think like that. They're totally like, okay, you do your key pose to your key pose to your key pose.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, that motion design punk rock approach of everything where it's just like, let me take this thing and turn it over and let's see if I break it. And let me, and just that principle of like duplicate and offset in any way, mm-hmm. and things get really interesting really quick. Yeah, so that kind of, I mean, it's funny that mashup of styles and mashup of techniques and really, like, we're talking a mashup of history. Full circle, history of now.
Why don't you give us the rundown of, like, where this all started to...
Oh, yeah, I wrote down a list, you know. Well, just thinking about, and we're going to, I'm thinking about it more in the modern incarnation of motion design. So, like, really looking at, like, you know, studios like RGA, right? So I got RGA founded in 1977 doing film titles, which are really, I think, kicking off the modern Atelier style of motion design. Curious Pictures, which started as Broadcast Arts in 1981, changed to Curious in 93. DK comes on, Digital Kitchen, in 1995. Then we've got, like, your Brand New School in 2000. I think PsyOps are around the same time. Superfad 2001. Buck in 2004. And of course, you know, there's a lot of other studios. I guess that sort of pre-2000 model, which is more motion graphics as this sort of extension of post-production, editorial and post houses, right? And then, you know, there's this departure where the design-driven studio model kind of breaks away from post-production and becomes kind of its own thing. And lots of different variations and forms too, right? There's not really like one model. I think design-driven is a good way. And I know that, like, concept-driven, and I was looking at Buck's site. They were calling themselves talent-driven, right? Like, there's a lot of different ways to describe it.
Design-driven has been an amazing articulate way to speak to what we do, but I found it very limiting because we called ourselves a design-driven production company for a while, because there was a point at where it was motion design, and then all of a sudden we're doing live action and editorial, and that really kind of confused people, like what that motion design could be more than After Effects. But then you get into design-driven production, and it's like, I think for us that is like the perfect way to talk about what we do. But once you, like, get out of our little bubble here, they're like, what does that fucking mean?
Right.
Like, what is design-driven production? Are you a production company or are you a design company?
And you're like, yes, I am.
As soon as you attach a word like production or design, like, it essentially becomes limiting.
I think it is somewhat limiting. And I'm always interested to see the way that the different studios describe themselves. From an educator's point of view, I like it when talking to students to kind of draw that continuum, mm-hmm. between, like, how we work as designers, where in a lot of ways, you know, we might work more like a traditional illustrator or a graphic designer, coming up with an idea, coming up with a concept, whether it is individual or you're doing that in a small team. But then the production side is where we're more like a film production company, and we're collaboration. And it becomes a really good way to say, hey, like, you need to learn how to play nice and listen and work with others and be a part of a team. Because this is where we maybe are different from, you know, just a graphic designer or just an illustrator, mm-hmm. who doesn't necessarily have to, right? They just have to work with their client, deliver it, get it done. And that definitely, I think, goes back to that traditional pre-2000 model of, you know, motion graphics as an extension of production and post-production specifically. And where probably that design infusion led the way to break away from that model and create these sort of independent studios. My entry in a significant way was with Curious Pictures. And at that time, in the early 2000s, the model was, you know, they had a team of CG and compositing, 2D compositing kind of on staff. And designers were freelancers. And I fit more in that designer mode. So I was there more in this sort of, you know, intern who became a freelance capacity, right? And then you had these other, you know, the new breed, from my point of view, were your brand new school and your PsyOps, that your leads, your staff, your core team were designers. And then they were bringing in CG, animator, and 2D freelancers. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if, I don't know what it was like at DK. Was it similar?
The editor was like the creative director there. And they really ran the job. If you look at their work, you'll see that the editorial is really what drove that place, combined with then this amazing designer.
Interesting.
They could tell a story. You could see if there's a narrative. Like, no matter what, you need a narrative or there's no story, you know? And so, like, an editor, when you take another step back, right, they're a director. Like, the best editors are, you know, they're the armchair director. A creative director and a director are two different things. They just are. And as a creative director and a director, I can say that, like, unequivocally, it's two totally different sensibilities. Like, I'm a good director and I'm a great creative director. You know what I mean? Like, they're two different things. And my way into directing was through creative direction, you know? And what I'm learning with direction is that where creative directing is a lot about, like, finding not just compromise, but, like, compromise is a big component about creative directing. You have your clients, artists working on it. You have to, like, kind of find a path forward to get to the best result while, like, kind of...
Right.
It's a dance, right? With directing, it's a different thing. You have to be the boss. You have to be the chief decider. You have to say to everybody, like, wherever you're at, whatever's going on, this is a decision that has to be made here. And that is like a different personality trait and core skill set that I think makes a great creative director.
Absolutely, right? Yeah, yeah. And you brought up, I mean, this is actually something I've been working on in this idea of, I mean, and this is not a pure correlation, but that idea of, like, when I think about working in something like an After Effects, right? Like, there's that sort of director's view, right? Where you're looking at the entire piece and does it flow? Does it work? But then you got it, like, seamlessly sort of get down to editor view to make sure that there's a whole view, and then down to a shot into animator view, all the way down to a single frame where you're like, is the composition, is everything perfect? And, you know, I think a lot of times a motion designer, you're sort of cycling through this. Right. And it's funny. That's actually, yeah, it's something I've been writing about, this sort of how you navigate through, I guess you'd say, different roles, you know, and I think that is, you know, and you just added a whole nother dynamic to it that I'll think about a bit. But I don't know how much of the last decade we've really covered, but we've kind of gone over the last two decades a bit.
But, right. Like, what have the last 10 years been like? The last 10 years have been really hard to be a design company, you know, especially, like, rooted in typography and animation.
We're still there. Oh, wow.
You know, I can't speak for every one of them, but it's like I picked up my head a year ago pre-COVID and I looked around and not many of my competitors were still around.
From my point of view as a sole operating artist, right, that
Sean.
There's actually been a lot of opportunity for someone like me where it's, and I've done, and I've kind of morphed, I mean, ad hoc or in tandem with my work as an educator, but direct to client, building direct to client relationships and enabled to, you know, anywhere from your 2 to 5 to 10 to $15,000 budgets that for a solo operator are great, right? Where I can stay busy all the time and do a lot of these smaller bite size, you know, pieces of these advertising budgets and needs.
Amazing.
Especially across platform, whether it's, you know, really, and it's like, I can't remember the last time I did a broadcast spot. It's all out of home, OOH or social, and or social. It's filling those needs.
Yeah. And for a studio like mine, it would right. be like, please, no. No, it's too much. Just to put a producer on it and a designer on it, like for a week, there's your budget, you know? And we all know it's never just that, right? No matter, once they got you, they got you. So if you're going to ask for an overage on like a $15,000 job, what's it going to be like a couple grand? Like, unless they just blow up the scope, you know what I mean? Proportionally. So,
right, right.
You're right. It has kind of created so much more opportunity for the individual that really has their shit together and the individual that can scale up with their buddy to kind of be a little bit more of a powerhouse, something like that, where it's two of you and one might be better with clients. One just wants to grind on the box. You know what I mean? But like for a studio, those jobs, you know, are they're kind of impossible unless you're doing insane volume.
You know, and it's interesting because, I mean, I think for me, my first forays into doing like so like direct to client stuff, it was all broadcast. Right. And I did enjoy that kind of like, OK, cool. I can grab this project. I could either, you know, I could concept, design, execute solo or with one or two others. But after doing a lot of that, I started to miss some of those, like, you know, there's no opportunities to dream really big here, like, because there's no budgets to do something crazy and there's no team to do something bigger than what I could achieve, you know. So it's, you know, some of that is that the grass is always greener, right? Where it's just like, I miss the big team, or I miss the big vision. Yeah.
Well, I mean, part of what I love, at least about what I've created, and I think about when I think about studios analogous, like Elastic and Imaginary Forces and the company. And I like pairing myself with them from a quality perspective, but also like we are not pigeonholed into making commercials, right? Like we of course make plenty of commercials, but we also make main title sequences. We also make special sequences in movies if there's like a montage sequence or a heads up display or something like that. We also make brand videos. We also make social everything. Vertical, horizontal, square, we make it all, right? Like we also do installation work. So if somebody's giving a big speech and they need a big keynote before them, like we make that. Right now we're working on something for SoFi Arena, which is part of the package when you go visit the arena when there's nothing going on. You can like run out onto the field and throw footballs around and do all sorts of cool shit. Like we're doing the tunnel run video for that. You know what I mean? That's fun. That's like six screens, like 4K each. It's bananas. Like the amount of work that's out there for a studio like ours, like a very diverse design driven, you know, we just make shit. We make all the shit. It's all moving. It's with all sorts of different mediums, but we're just makers and we can put it anywhere. So like stylistically, I think me and the people I mentioned, and of course many other studios, we like to not pigeonhole ourselves because we are conceptual thinkers and design led and do things that are appropriate for that ask. And I love that about us, but I think in the 2000s specifically, that was very hard for studios like us because that's when everybody wanted, I want a specialist. I want the guy that does realistic looking fruit on a seamless background with the real flow happening. And it's like, well
and like, also like
we don't have that. I mean, we can make that, but we don't have that. Like everything was like highly specialized.
And
if you look at each company individually and every company out there, everybody's kind of knocking on some other doors too. Like, we're going a little bit into long format here and there. We just produce a documentary series, right? Like, that's super cool. I have a couple directors on my roster, so it was perfect for them, and it was perfect for me as an opportunity to be like a legit producer.
Nice. Well, I think, yeah. I mean, I think it, you know, the lesson, right? The lesson of this, you know, I think last couple decades, right? Adapt, right? Adapt or die. Right?
Adapt or die.
You know, and I think, you know,
yeah.
From, again, bringing back to the educator's point of view, it's that's what I'm trying to teach the students is it's, yeah. You know, you're a creative problem solver. Right. These are all the tools. Like, there's a lot of different tools, but mm-hmm. one of those tools is learn how to adapt, learn how to keep evolving and to be sustainable.
That is the most important yeah. thing you could teach a student is that this software you're using will not be the same in 5 years. But that's okay, because not only did you learn this software,
right.
you learned the fundamentals, and that is what will keep you moving.
It's like, learn how to interface. Like, if you learn how to learn interfaces, you can more or less learn any software and not be, you know,
yeah.
you know, and I think that goes back to that idea of the specialist, the generalist, right? It's like, you know, a specialist that can adapt, well, mm-hmm. they go away as the environment changes, as the habitat changes, like whether it's just a species or a designer, mm-hmm. right?
You got to do the work. You can't skip the doing the work part. That's, and it's never going to be easy. The technology is never going to be at a place where you like think it and it's there. Like, you've got to put in the time.
Any final thoughts on on this episode of
All right, well,
History
that's,
of Now?
No more thoughts on the History of Now. I'm hoping to talk less about myself in the future, which is good. But it's through the lens, right? Through our lens of time, and, you know, to like record these kind of little kind of conversations between us that we would have had anyway that are just a little bit more guided topically. But
yeah,
if anybody's listening, they know we like veer.
Hang on tight.
We veer, you know,
all over the place here.
I think it's going to be fun though. I think it's going to be fun putting these together.
All right.
Okay. I'm going to do the Austin piece. Does it work on
you?
It works on you.
Why not?
It works on you.
Own it.
Peace. I mean, we could use a little peace out there.